With CarGurus Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and CarGurus Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder CarGurus is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with CarGurus at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Do You Remember with
Carl Spain
and Tony Kelly. I am Tony Kelly, of course.
And I'm still Carl Spain.
There you go. This episode is just as exciting as all the other episodes will be, but I have to say I really enjoyed this chat, Carl.
It was a genuinely fantastic chat. It's nice doing the intro afterwards.
Yes.
So we don't need to fake build it up. Oh, this was amazing. No, genuinely, I feel like I've been influenced by Mario. It was a great chat. In many ways, I felt like we asked him one question and he just kept talking.
But that's great. That's kind of what we were trying to do with this podcast.
Yeah.
Start out with your childhood and then tell us how you got here. But like, I remember we were talking about doing a short list of people we wanted on the podcast, and Mario was probably the first we talked about, because we'd got the first one done early on. And I was actually, and myself, Mario, and yourself have built up quite a rapport. We did the film together and blah, 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 blah. We'd shows on the books and all that kind of stuff that we were going to do. But I still was a bit nervous to ask Mario to do it. Like,
I know, it's an awkward thing asking someone, because we did ask someone else before to be on it, and they said no. They didn't feel like doing podcasts, yeah. But we're not going to say who that was.
No, an eccentric man, though.
Yeah, but that's part for the code. If someone doesn't want, it's not personal. I understand that.
Yeah.
But Mario was great, and I felt like... you left him, you said, oh, we'll see you again. And I feel we will revisit Mario, because...
Yeah.
I reckon there's a lot more he can remember. I know we got a good podcast, but I think there's loads more.
Yeah, like we got into...
The rich mine we could have...
One of the things that myself and Mario kind of, I won't necessarily say bonded on, but we hit it off with straight away when we first met each other, was I'm very much from Waterford, as you can hear with my accent, that I can never try and disguise. Mm. Mario spent a lot of his childhood in Waterford, considers himself from Waterford, is from Waterford, and... We kind of start there, but we really get into...
Two films made in Waterford, one directed by Stanley Kubrick, one by Tony Kelly,
yeah.
And there's a Rosenstock in both of them.
There you go. Oh, I like that, yeah.
Yeah.
To find out what Carol is talking about,
listen
to this episode. So without any further ado, Mr...
Mario Rosenstock. As I meant to say that quicker, yeah. I normally say my own name.
Okay, do you remember with...
Carl Spain.
And me, Tony Kelly. The ad, of course, was just Carl Spain's voice doing that.
Carl Spain.
Exactly. Yeah, but we're delighted for this episode to be joined by the one and only Mario Rosenstock. Mario, how are you?
Tony, Carl, absolute pleasure to be here. Delighted to be here. Can't wait to see how this turns out.
I know, we were saying the same thing driving up here today.
It feels like we booked Mario so that we can go. And we also, next week, we've got Gay Byrne, we've got Keith Duffy.
There we are,
Mary. We've genuinely got Miriam.
I do two Keith Duffys. One, which is when he had the gap in his teeth.
Yeah.
And two, when he has turkey teeth. They're basically the same, but, you know, he did change, you know.
One's got a lisp and one hasn't.
Yeah, slightly, yeah. So, you know, so he's a great character. I love those characters. Gift Grub is full of characters who, it's not a nasty take on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like as if there's a joyful take on them. So I see Keith Duffy as a kind of an endlessly hopeful character, a character that bounces back from all sorts of setbacks and keeps coming back. You know, I might have been a backing singer that couldn't sing, but now I have Tireland. And you're going, fantastic. Better. No, I couldn't think of a better result than Tireland.
It's funny you should say that, because I watched the Boys' Own documentary.
Yeah.
That everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
And Keith, first of all, referred to himself as the fella in the background with the broken teeth.
Yeah.
Which I thought was wonderfully self-depreciating.
Yeah.
But then he was like, you know, I was in the doldrums. I couldn't sing and I'd been in the band. What am I going to do now? Ah, I did 10 years of Corrie. Just like yeah. that.
And the clinic.
Yeah. The clinic.
Sorry. I have to follow all this.
Okay.
So the two things happen out of these things. I have the most peculiar job.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I would know when these extraordinarily unusual birthdays of
okay.
people. You know, Jose Mourinho. I know when his birthday is. Enda Kenny, same day as Eamon Gilmore, which was ironic because they were in government together.
Right.
Bertie Ahern, the 12th of September. How do I know that? It was the day after 9/11. I remember we couldn't do a sketch on Bertie. Nobody was doing a sketch after 9/11. I remember it was Bertie's birthday and I had the whole birthday planned. for the gift grub. Roy Keane, 8th of August. You know, all these birthdays. So I have to know them all. You know, that kind of thing. So it's just bizarre, you know.
But do you feel like looking back on the gift grub, it's almost like a reeling in the ears, looking back over your career, because it's every, you know, you're documenting it as it's going along.
Yeah, we document politics. Like, people have come up to me many times over the years, all sorts of ages, and gone, "You're the only access I've had to politics in Ireland," and I'm going, "Oh, you poor fucker."
You know,
didn't I just say that?
Yeah. No, and they went, "No, I knew the names of the cabinet and everything because of you.
Yeah.
I knew who the Minister for Finance was because of you, and otherwise I had no interest." Mm-hmm. And I went, "But you knew them in a very specific way from the radio then."
I still think the one that made me, and it seems, when you did Stephen Roach reading out the lyrics to Romeo and Juliet.
Why are you coming around here singing about people like that?
And it made me laugh.
Anyway, what are you going to do about it, John?
I was in work, and I remember stopping and just howling, laughing. And I'm kind of going, why is it even, you know, why is that funny? But it was just perfect.
Yeah, well, radio is a perfect vehicle, because Tony Fenton would always say, it's the theatre of the mind, dude. And that is it, you know, you're driving along Buttbridge and you hear what sounds like Bertie Ahern or something approaching him doing something like taking a sauna in Finland or something, and you're going, I believe it. And it's your mind that's creating the picture, not me. And so radio is the most beautiful medium, I think, in the world, because of the pictures that the audience creates.
Yeah.
And also, if I want Bertie or Michael D. Higgins to go back and have a dream that they are Alexander the Great going over the Alps on an elephant, I can create that for no money.
Yeah, say the budget is very.
Whereas
important.
I was going to go, if you said, we want that in the hurler, lads.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for the elephants for start?
I was going to say we were all in, we were all in it because I fucking made it. Yeah. But we were all in a low budget film that I had to try and piece this thing together for. We can say it now. I was told when it was coming out never to say how much it was made for, because people won't want it. It was made for less than €88,000, right? Got into a cinema in every county in the country, number one on Amazon Prime when it was released. But at the same time, we had limits to what we could do. We certainly couldn't make Michael D. Higgins go over the Alps.
Exactly. So there's no budget involved.
No.
I mean, even you say that, right? There was a filmmaker called Terry McMahon.
I know Terry, yeah.
Who made a film called Charlie Casanova.
Yeah, brilliant film.
And he made it on Facebook, basically. He asked everybody just to say, will you do me a favour on Facebook? I'm at my wit's end. I want to make a fucking movie. Mm-hmm. And I want to do it for nothing. And I think he made it for less than £1,000 or something.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
And it was actually, you know, it was a good movie in terms of its ambition.
But just to say, I think it's important that I say, like, Terry McMahon is a genius, by the way, so I should not even be in the same sentence. Just
an intense genius, though.
But who's the other director that made a film in Waterford there in the past?
Stanley Kubrick. Kubrick, that was it, yeah, Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick.
I know the film.
And Tony Kelly.
Sorry, you're actually telling, you know, I thought that was an inadvertent joke, was it?
Well, we know that it's a fact that Stanley Kubrick made the film.
Barry Lyndon.
Correct.
In Waterford.
You don't know that my father was in it.
You told me that.
I did.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Carol didn't.
I didn't know that.
My father was working, he had his own cigarette machine business out beyond the court, as you do, boy. So my father, right, he was able to work there, right, and he was there looking for something. So he had two ideas, right? He had the boot bunnies. Do you know what a boot bunny is?
No, I don't.
So it was a piece of wood which looked like a bunny's ears.
Right.
And it's for taking your shoes off as they come in the hall.
Lovely.
Right? That didn't go well. Okay. So he went, I'm getting into the portable cigarette machine business. So that didn't go great either. So he says, I might as well become an extra. Your man Stanley Kubrick is making Barry Lyndon up beyond.
Fairly, isn't it?
So Stanley Kubrick made what is now my favourite movie of all time.
Really? Barry Lyndon is?
Barry Lyndon is my favourite, not because my father in it and not because it was in Waterford.
It's a beautiful film.
Barry Lyndon is a film which has grown and grown and grown in stature over the years since it was made. It was regarded as a flop when it first came out because Kubrick had just made 2001 A Space Odyssey and Clockwork Orange. And it was regarded as a flop. But like a lot of Kubrick things, he was way, way ahead of the curve, and now it's grown and grown and grown. If you look at it now, it's stunning.
Well, we were at the Galway Comedy Festival a few months ago, and we kind of both did this little thing where we were saying it's The Hurler is the second highest grossing film to ever be made in Waterford. Just behind Barry Lyndon.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I love it.
And who's third?
Well, no,
there was no other film was made, no other in film made in Waterford.
Yeah. But, and Colleen Hume was in Dungarvan.
All right.
Well, I think the key grip on Fatal Deviation came from Waterford. Mikey Graham's movie.
Really?
Oh, Jesus. It's regarded as the worst movie of all time.
Oh, well, thank God for
Fatal Deviation.
But I've seen lots of it, but I haven't seen the full movie. Yeah.
Listen, Mario, we speak a lot about your childhood in Waterford and stuff like that. And this is a Do You Remember podcast.
Yeah, okay.
What I kind of, I suppose, to like to know, first of all, like music is tied into Giffgrub a lot. A lot of your big success breakthrough stuff was through music. I remember, for example, your Jose Mourinho singing Joseph's Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and it was based on the song.
I suppose my question with that, with music being such a tie-in to what you've done, do you remember the first record that you bought?
Well, I can remember everything to do with music in all sorts of ways through my childhood. I remember I had a very, very deep relationship with my grandfather and grandmother, and I remember they lived in Waterford, and I remember walking up to the farm with my grandfather, and I'd be holding his hand walking up the lane, and we'd be walking towards the haggard in the farm, and he'd be singing, "And I love you so." Sun is going down, I'm holding his hand, I'm five. The people ask me how. Perry Como, and I love you so, and that was my earliest memory of music like that. My grandmother and her daughter, my aunt Caroline, would sing The Carpenters' "Close to You" to me, because I was born on the same month that was number one.
Okay.
And they sit over the bed and they go, "Why do birds suddenly appear?" There you are, Mario, every time. So I had that song blazing to my head. And then later, Gilbert O'Sullivan, because Gilbert O'Sullivan is Waterford. And that song, Alone Again, naturally, in a little while from now. And Gilbert O'Sullivan, of course, a cast iron genius.
Absolutely, and a Cork Road man.
Absolutely. And what a lot of people don't know is that song, Alone Again, naturally, a peculiarly sad and morose song, was number one in the United States for 6 weeks.
Well, I didn't know it was that long.
Number one.
What fascinates me about it, right, Gilbert O'Sullivan.
I know you,
right?
Exactly,
but this song, like, obviously growing up in Waterford, it's, "Oh, Gilbert is from the Cork Road, boy." You know what I mean? "He's one of our own. You want to listen to that one?" So you're listening to Alone Again, naturally. I mean, even as a young man, you're going, "Oh, this upbeat," you know, not necessarily in a major key, but like this upbeat, din, 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 din. And then when you get to a little bit older, you're listening to the, "Hang on now, this one left him at an altar. He's going to go to the top of a tower and throw himself off."
Suicide.
Yeah, you're going, my God.
He loses his, "Mother, God rest her soul," couldn't understand why the only man she had ever loved had been taken. Dad dies. He then goes, "I hate religion." And then he goes, "I want to throw myself off a building." And the Americans go, "Love that guy." Mad. And I remember then we had a Beatles songbook. And a Beatles songbook was the words of the Beatles and in the keys and the lyrics and the guitar chords. And we would finger away at the guitar chords. Mm-hmm. And my auntie and my uncle, I could just hear them rooms here, making each day of the year, both of us knowing here, there and everywhere, and all the songs. So Maxwell, Silverhammer, bit oblique Beatles songs.
About a serial killer, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm dark. And I was getting all these dark messages. And then I remember it was 77 a bit now, and I remember 78 maybe, and I'm 8. And then I remember a record came into the house, and it was Saturday Night Fever, and it was the Bee Gees.
Okay.
And I remember hearing like "How Deep Is Your Love?" And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever heard anything so beautiful in my life.
Yeah.
And I still think to this day, not only two things. Not only are the Bee Gees grossly underrated.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
They are one of the greatest. For me, they're up there with ABBA, because I have this thing about ABBA. As melody and a melody and a melody and feeling.
Yeah.
That song, for example, is one of the most beautiful songs ever written. As is "Dancing Queen" by ABBA. I mean, ridiculous.
But have you seen the Bee Gees documentary that they did? It's up there. Like, it's right of all the rock and roll, Woodstock, Rolling Stones with the Hell's Angels, all those documentaries. The two best music documentaries I've ever seen are the Bee Gees and the Eagles.
I was just going to say Boyzone.
Well, maybe it's up there.
I haven't seen the Eagles.
The Eagles one's unbelievable because they killed each other, right? It's hilarious. But the Bee Gees one is beautiful.
And did you love Joe Walsh?
Love Joe Walsh. Mm,
everybody loves Joe Walsh.
Love Joe Walsh. Mm. But no, I actually weirdly like Glenn Frey.
Yeah, I like Glenn Frey.
He's...
And Don Henley, man. Henley. Boys of Summer.
Yeah. Henley just doesn't take any shit. There's a line in the Eagles one, right, where the other guitar player, Don Fielder, wanted to sing Hotel California or something like that. And Glenn Frey says, why would we get anyone else? He said, I even stopped singing songs. Don Henley's in our band, right?
Yeah.
And it cuts to Don Henley and he goes, I didn't ask to play the guitar solo on Hotel California.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's like,
yeah,
I'm the best singer in the band. They just know how good they are.
So Barry Gibb, for example, is just a total genius. And as brothers, they harmonise in an unbelievable way, which only brothers can do, like the Everlys, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another song actually that came into my mind and it reflects a different period of my life. So after, for a brief while, I moved to, remember I said my dad had a cigarette business. Well, I moved back with my parents for a brief while in Woodlawn Grove.
Oh my God. This is blowing my mind.
Opposite Waterford Glasdale. Yeah. Arco.
Yeah.
Arco.
Not far from where I live.
Arco and Anko, near Waterford Glasdale, the swimming pool by.
Yeah.
And so we were there living in Woodlawn Grove and I was 11 or 12. And this was a kind of a thing whereby you then had friends, your mates.
Sure.
And the mates would tell you, right, we're all mad into AC/DC.
Yeah.
And so are you. And you go, yeah, yeah. What's your favourite band? AC fucking DC. I didn't know a fucking word of AC/DC.
I like Madness,
you
know, this as well. Madness
Yeah. So then the thing would come, do you hear the news, boy? Highway to Hell is out. I never, oh great, yeah. We're all meeting over at my house tonight to listen to Highway to Hell. I went, oh, okay. So I'd be there, knock on the door, there, into the good room.
Yeah.
Mother brought us into the good room. Shoot. We'd lock the door. He'd lock the door, Kevin would lock the door, and the three of us in the room. And we literally just go like this. Right? He would go, and we just literally, we just sit there, doing our heads like this, right? And I kind of looked at them, and they weren't getting up.
Yeah.
They were just sitting there, going mad with their heads, and I'm going, oh, I better do the same thing then. So we're all there. So it's basically headbanging.
Yeah.
Fucking ridiculous.
Was that your first impression, was it?
Yeah.
Copying the lads.
Yeah, that's it. My first impression was a long, long time before that. I was hearing music and hearing pitches and voices for years. And on the farm and everything. I grew up on a farm, so a farm is a very dark place to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And it can inform your sense of humour. And I mean, I would do the cow noises and the dog noises and everything. And I was just saying to somebody, the cow noise used to inform my Jerry Adams. So it was like, but then I turned in later. I was running, how do I do Jerry? And I said, remember the cow? It was called Val. So I went, that's the cow.
And my grandmother sounded very like Michael J. Higgins. So she would sound like that, Radio 4, the Listen with Mother and the Archers.
My God.
And I remember you sound very like, so it's making connections. So
did
I don't.
You, did
I,
you use them? Did you ever do like prank calls as,
yes,
hello, this is your granny now here. You wouldn't look, I'm trying to surprise Mario, send some money to Mario.
Worse.
Would you have done that?
Worse. I this happened when I was 26 actually. a friend of mine, my best friend Nick said, come here, you, this is before I was on the radio, and he went, you're fucking good at impressions. And I went, yeah, I'm doing a thing, it's a business story. And I went, what's the business story? He went, I'm trying to prove that it's possible to break into people's bank accounts just by ringing up.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
And I went, and he went, yeah. And he went, you do Eamon Dunphy, don't you? And I went, yeah. And who else? And I went, at the time I was just came out, David Norris.
Oh, God, yeah.
And of course I do David Norris, but I do so many types of David Norris. I do David Norris that can do a Dublin accent. So we go, oh, yeah, you're only joking me.
That's right. So anyway,
I rang up
a bank,
mm-hmm,
and I pretended I was Eamon Dunphy. And they went, hello? I went, this is Eamon Dunphy. And I'd like to know my account balance, please. And they went, sorry, they sent a bit, Mr. Dunphy, what's the number? I don't have it to hand. Look, baby, just give me my account balance. I need to buy some flowers for my mother. And I went, they gave me the balance.
Wow.
They gave me the balance.
Statute of limitations has long passed.
Yeah, they gave me the balance, and I did the same as David Norris, and they gave me the balance. And it happened. So basically, this was before, of course.
Wow.
The internet wasn't there.
No.
1996, it was just about to start.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was hilarious. Be able to get into somebody's bank account.
So the musical ear, right, leads itself to the impression.
It does, yeah.
Right? And then the impression leads to the prank phone calls and the laugh with the lads.
Yeah.
How does it lead to a career?
I was an actor, so I don't know. There's something, psychologically, I've looked into this in my own world. I was mad about tennis.
Okay.
And I was a tennis jock. And I was quite good at tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of occurred to me after years of looking back at this, that tennis actually was a precursor to what I really wanted to do, which was to be on stage,
mm-hmm,
and to be watched by a crowd.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that tennis is a stage. So my line, your line, my line, your line. Oh, wow. Two actors exchanging lines, and the audience go, oh, rather good. Right? And so it was that tension of being on stage that I was loving, not so much the tennis. It was the, I was loving being in the center of a stage.
Yeah.
And having watched movies, I was quite movie literate from a young age. And I said, no, that's what I want. And I saw my brother in a play in school. And I went, no, the lights are shining on him. He looks way too good. Way too good. And I looked around and all the girls were looking up at him. Mm. Now, he's a handsome fella, but all the girls were looking at, up at him. And I was just going, no, I'm not having this. This is me. So basically, it was the idea of, I love acting, I love performing, but I also love the attention and I loved the girls thing as well.
Right.
I love the idea of getting the girls. Yeah. Really did. Mm-hmm. And access to girls. The idea that you could jump ahead in the queue by, you know, eons by just being the guy that was had the lead role.
Yeah.
So you go, I'm only the seventh best looking guy in the class. But with this, nobody can hold me. I'm first. I get any girl.
Yeah.
So basically...
What school was this?
Gilbert O'Sullivan, number one for 6 weeks.
Totally. Yeah. So this was Ashton. This was a boarding school in Cork called Rochelle House.
Okay.
I was just after I left Waterpark.
Okay.
And so it was the idea of being on stage, loving performing, having a real grow to do it,
mm-hmm.
and but loving the attention as well, and loving the love. Yeah. I mean, and again, this is a psychological thing, but my parents split up a lot when I was a kid, and mm-hmm. there's a bit of a vacuum there. And I think you look to fill that vacuum. And the vacuum was basically pour as much love as you can into me because I need it.
And was the impressions, was that there, so if you're chatting up a girl or you meet strangers?
No, it was more at home, and yeah. I put on little playlets and everything. But it was a tool that I would use as an actor.
Yeah.
So I was acting away. And so Mario, can you do, for example, a magistrate? And I'd be going, yeah, of course I could do fucking magistrate. I'd be easy.
Mm.
And they'd be there, oh, well, you really can. Or, well, what about a New Yorker? Or what about an American?
Mm.
Like, this is when you're like 19 or 18 or so. Well, what kind of an American are you looking for? I can do 7 different types.
Yeah.
And they'd go, oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Or what about all the different Irish accents? Yeah, I could do 23 different ones. Or Britain regionals in Britain.
Sure, yeah.
So you could do that. And then I was copying people, like, you know, I remember Michael Douglas, being fascinated by Michael Douglas in Wall Street.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant. And he was like, greed, for want of a better word, is good. Greed for life, greed for power, greed for money.
That's great.
Greed is what's going to save this malfunctioning corporation known as the United States of America. Thank you very much.
We're going to have to pay for a clip now.
And then, and then it was just this kind of, I was just copying these guys. Like Pellas would copy Jack Nicholson or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Although I used to pick more obscure, like James, you know, face the master, James Mason.
Oh, wow.
My face against your faith. Face it, face up to it, old man. Holy man, holy man. Or time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future. If you didn't know who that was, that's Alec Guinness.
Alec Guinness.
So,
but like, this is, even the uniqueness of the impressions you're choosing.
Yeah.
Here, like when you're younger, you're doing Nicholson or,
yeah.
you know, there's obvious ones.
Yeah.
But what was drawing you to those unique...
I didn't want to be the same as everybody else.
Right.
So everybody was doing, you know, back in our day in the 70s, like, ooh, Betty and Michael Crawford. I wasn't into any of that.
Yeah.
I was always trying to find something a little bit different. And then I never saw them as impressions either. So as soon as I would get an impression, I would immediately start making them saying something else. So I'd start doing Michael Jackson goes into water park and starts having a fight with one of the teachers.
Right.
Michael Douglas or whatever, right? So it was the idea that it was a creative engine that I was actually interested in, not the voice.
Mm.
And to this day, I have no interest in the voices. I have hardly any interest. I have very, very surface interest in the voices. I'm much more interested in what do these guys say and what do these guys do.
As an actor, like, let's say you're doing a play and you're playing a certain character, would you ever, on a night, go, you know, tonight I'm going to be Alec Guinness as that character, or I'm going to be Michael Douglas, or I'll put in something... just for the other actors going, what the hell is this, Mario? You know,
no.
Did you ever do any of that?
I wouldn't have because I'd be a bit of a lovey. So I would be
too
going,
much respect for the craft.
Too much respect.
I was just about to,
I wouldn't be one of those fellas that would, you know, remember the famous story about the fella, the phone rings on stage. And do you remember that?
Go on, yeah.
You should know. You know every story, Spain.
Yeah.
You're a disgrace to your profession.
Spain.
Fuck you and your anecdotes, Spain. You're useless. Anyway, the phone rings on stage. Your man can't remember his line and he goes, it's for you.
answer to the other actor. I love the other actor is, what the fuck is going on
is
here?
It the Peter O'Toole one I loved when he said, like, they get hammered, they go in, just watch the first half of the play or something like, oh, it gets good now, I come on.
Yeah, yeah. Or Cyril Cusack, the great Cyril Cusack, who used to upstage every other actor on stage by, he'd keep shuffling down the stage so that the other actor has to look. And they go, why is Cyril walking backwards? And so that everybody's looking at Cyril and your man has turned his back to the audience. Yeah. You know,
I was told I did a panto and I was told a couple of years before someone did that and the other actor just started to realise what was going on. So they started to come back. And if you had a guess, I bet you'd get it right.
Well, but see what you're saying about walking backwards on a stage, coming up on doing a play and doing an accent that wasn't prepared beforehand is 1 million times worse than that.
So my thing was... my thing wasn't accents or voices. It's more the comedy.
Yeah,
I'm interested in the comedy. I mean, I used to watch a lot of comedy.
So this was my next question: who was your first comedic hero then?
Too many. Mm-hmm. I was omnivorous. Okay. Omnivorous. So I think my first comic influence would definitely be in Sesame Street.
Really?
Totally. And Sesame Street, of course, is full of genius professionals who are genius at writing sketches. Mm-hmm. They set up little sketches. The sketches are gentle, though. So Ernie and Bert has a beginning, middle and end, mm-hmm. and a comic payoff. I remember Kermit the Frog, the Muppet News flashes. Here I am, a Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Jack, what are you going to do? I'm going to jump over the candlestick. He's going to jump over the candlestick. And I just remember thinking this historical thing, you know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing, you know, beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the idea of going back in time, the idea that anything is possible, the idea of relationships, give and take, you know, and even I remember the food. Food, food, food. Sound like Pat Kenny. But anyway, there's all these ways. They just played with things. Yeah. Snuffleupagus, the imaginary creature that mm-hmm. we all know.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing. And then that led to The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
The Muppet Show is real comedy.
Yeah.
And then, so I was watching a lot of puppets. And then at the same time, I was watching a lot of British sitcoms.
This is me.
Sitcoms. So I would have grown up with Fawlty and that sort of stuff. A little bit of Monty Python. Although Monty Python was beyond me in a sense, because it was a little outré when I was 9 or 10.
Sure, yeah.
And it is, you know, it's very undergraduate, mm-hmm. you know. And he's like, oh, very clever. Plato and Aristotle playing football. And I'm there, who's play over?
Yeah, who that by?
Who's play? And I'd watch even simple ones. Oh, I remember Leonard Rossiter in Rising Damp. And I remember looking at Leonard Rossiter just going, this guy's a genius. Mm. I don't know. What's his name again, Gran? And he go, Leonard Rossiter, he's fantastic. And I go, I'm just going, he's a genius. Like, there's no question. And nobody would say he's a genius. He was just the actor in this thing. It's only like since he died, of course, the usual thing
sure.
that people admit. Leonard Rossiter was a complete comic genius, also in Barry Lyndon. Mm-hmm. And
Reggie Perrin, I used to love Reggie.
Reginald Perrin is one of the greatest British sitcoms of all time. And again, it stands up right now because it's totally daft and totally, it's quite satirical as well.
Unbelievable.
And very dark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dark. I remember the hippopotamus.
I didn't get where I am today.
I didn't get where I am today by saying I didn't get where I am today.
Super.
Wait. And the hippopotamus.
Yeah, yeah.
She turns into the hippopotamus and mother-in-law.
Yeah, Audrey Roberts.
22 minutes later.
Yeah, the woman who played.
Reggie, you're 22 minutes late again. Yeah, so leaves on the track. But I mean, genius. Total genius.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When did it kind of drop with you? That it's kind of all, it's not just an illusion, that there's so much more to it. I remember a moment, and I was thinking about this only yesterday, that everyone was saying that David Jase and Del Boy, you know, like, as your working class area in Waterford, only fools and horses, that's the thing that, like, all your dad and his mates, this is the funniest thing ever.
Yeah.
It's funny, it was never my big thing. Mm-hmm. But
me neither.
Yeah.
But I totally appreciate it.
But David Jase, oh my God, but I remember going, he doesn't write this though. He's only saying the lines.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the writer?
John Sullivan.
And then I found out who John Sullivan was, and I was probably 12 or 13 going, but the writer's the genius.
What I always found interesting about Only Fools and Horses on reflection was how John Sullivan wrote it on his own.
Yes.
Which is very unusual not to be in a writing team.
Yes.
And I always wonder what it was like for John with a piece of paper and just walking
That's
around.
What he did. Mm. He was Citizen Real Smith stories, was before it? That.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote it on Byron pages and brought it in. And
what
someone
an extraordinary
saw it.
Mind.
Someone saw it and went, this is...
Yeah, what an extraordinary mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But did you have that moment, Mario, where you were like, someone in Sesame Street realised about the Jack be nimble, Jack be quick, or Jack jump over the camp, like, and you go, it's not Kermit the Frog doing this, it's Jim Henson or whoever it is.
No.
And did you go like, I have to write that for myself?
No. I was so daft. I was just like, I was in the moment watching this. Mm-hmm. And I want to... And that's why, like, when I watch films now, I get completely lost in the film. and I don't even sometimes know fully what might happen in the narrative. Okay. I want to be sucked up by the film. Mm-hmm. So like, I introduced my son Dash, right? He's 17 now, but when he was 12, I started going, Your film education starts now. And this is some of the most beautiful moments I've had with my son, right? Yeah. So I have a list of films that long that we've watched together. And I think he was about 15, maybe 14 and a half, when I went, I'll give him a go at One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Wow. And I think he's ready for it, because he'd watched enough narratives to understand. And I said, I'll try this. And after 10 minutes, he was there. Yeah. I know what's going to happen in this. And I went, what? What do you mean? It's just started. What? Tell me. And he went, the guy, what's his name again?
R.P. McMurphy.
R.P. McMurphy.
Jack Nicholson guy.
Oh, sorry.
Randall. Yeah.
Yeah, him. Randall P. McMurphy.
Him. Well, what about him? He's going to go in and he's going to show all the others eventually that they're not as mad as they think.
Mm.
And something's going to happen with the Indian guy. How do you fucking know this? And I worked it out by how I know it, how he knew it. It's because we live in a different generation, and the kids now live in a narrative generation whereby they are watching clues all the time in 3-minute form, from TikTok,
yes,
to Fortnite,
yeah,
to the games they play. They have narratives as well, and sure, they spot arcs and trends and really quickly.
Jesus,
and it was like he knows what's going to happen, and he was right.
Jesus, I had to go to college in America for that.
Yeah, so I let movies pass over me, right? That, like this. So it never dawned on me, is the answer to your question, who was doing it or who was what. What dawned on me was that this place here that we now sit in, that's a big, big, big business, was once a very small, tiny little place called Today FM in Abbey Street. And it was going under. It was Radio Ireland, and it was going under. It was used to called Radio 0%. Because we had 0.
Radio No Tomorrow FM.
We had 0.6 or something of a percentage point on the listeners, and the radio people rounded it down to zero.
Wow.
Rounded it down.
Wow.
So the radio, the papers then called it Radio 0%.
Oh.
And it was a crazy radio station called Radio Ireland.
And I used to listen.
And it was rebranded in 1998, and a radical departure was made, and they decided to bring on Eamon Dunphy at 5 o'clock in the evening to do a program called The Last Word.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a fellow doing a bit of comedy called Navin Man, and Stuart Carlin, who wrote Love Hate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he did Navin Man and The Drunken Politician. And it started taking off. Dunphy's show started taking off. Still radio 0%. And then they hit the jackpot. They decided to put their hands in their pocket, and John McColgan got out his checkbook and he made the biggest gamble ever.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to hire the biggest name in breakfast radio, Ian Dempsey. And not only that, they put a chunk of money. You know the way you make films and they go, well, the movie had a budget of 100 million, but the marketing budget was another 100
million. Yeah.
They did that.
Okay.
So they hired Dempsey for X whatever, and then they put another X into the marketing.
Okay.
And they emblazoned the town in a yellow poster with a big smiling Dempsey, and it just said, look who we poached for breakfast.
Oh, lovely.
And everybody went, that's fucking clever.
Mm-hmm.
That's cheeky. It's clever and it's sparky and it's a little anti-establishment.
Yeah.
And Dempsey came over and then you've got Dunphy, Dempsey 5, 5, 9, win breakfast and you win the day.
Yeah.
Stay with the day and then you have Dunphy in the evening. And then they hired Ray Darcy.
Yeah.
At his peak.
Yeah. Mm.
With Mairead and Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it was just all day. And huge, huge, huge. And then so Dempsey had worked with Zig and Zag and
that's
all
that. That's how I knew him, yeah.
I was doing,
Dempsey's den.
I had sent in my tape to Radio Ireland on a kind of a, I love Radio 4, I want to be a radio presenter like my grandmother, and as an actor I'll do something, I'll interview you or something. And they said, the person I was living with at the time, two girls from New Zealand in a flat, they'd heard me doing the voices in every morning in the shower. And they were going, Mario, all these crazy voices, Jerry Adams and all this, that great. You know, you should do them on the radio. And I went, I'm an actor. I don't do voices on the radio.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear my Alec Guinness? And they're like, no, we don't know who Alec Guinness is, but we know who Jerry Adams is and Bertie Ahern.
Mm-hmm.
So they went, blah, 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 blah. And I was 27 years of age. And they said, can you come in and just show us your voices? So I just got into a taxi, thought nothing of it. I laid down about 80 voices. In a mic, thought nothing of it. They rang me back the next day and they went, can you write? And I went, no, I can't write. Would you try writing? And I went, well, I will. And then that's when the moment that you asked your question.
This is what, yeah.
I had to basically transform what I was doing into something that looks that's on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the hardest part. And still is.
Yeah, but that's why
writing is the hardest part.
And we
but
can
still
all
still the most rewarding when you get it right.
Any idea of the quantity of stuff you've done?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I'd love to know as well.
It's in excess, because we have to do it because we're making jokes about it in the new tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's in excess of 8,500 sketches. That's all of those sketches at 3.5+ minutes.
But and just for aspiring writers and anyone else listening to this, like, that's it. Mario just said he can't write, finds it hard to write.
8,500
sketches.
I had to write.
This is it.
There's an interesting story in this, though, as well, which is totally true. And it's worth for anybody listening to know about this. So I remember about a month into it, I had a big success with a sketch. And it's where I had a load of characters singing at the same time. And I spent about 4 hours overdubbing the voices myself from mini disc to CD to CD to mini disc, mini to CD. Mm. Quality wasn't great, but the sketch was funny. And they'd never heard anything like this before.
Sure.
And I was generating all the voices. And you could hear all the individual voices on the thing. And they were singing a song. And I finished it at about midnight, and I went home like bleary eyed, and I got up and I came in the next morning for a meeting, and they went, Mario, the response to that was amazing. And I started, like, I was a bit emotional because I was so tired, and I went, great, great, great. And they went, so what's tomorrow?
Yeah.
And I went, I actually kind of broke down. I didn't see that coming, the words, what's tomorrow?
Yeah.
And that's when I said, I started shaking and everything, and I had a little bit of a spell.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just had to, nowadays you would have gone, you know, I had a mental health episode that I needed to go away for therapy for a while there. But what happened was that I had a little bit of a moment.
Okay.
And I had to go home I took the week off. I had to go home and have a think. And basically my life changed in that week, the beginning of my life changing in that week. How did it change? So it changed because I had to radically overhaul who I thought I was and what I was doing.
Yeah.
See, for me, I was an actor who was basically busking this thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And as long as it went well, I'd stay with it. I had to get into a frame of mind where I went, no, this is everything I do. I am this.
Mm-hmm.
Not I do this, I am it.
Yeah.
Which means that everything I see, hear, taste, smell, touch is going to lead to another sketch.
Mm-hmm.
So I started taking a notebook and writing notes, and the notes got longer and longer and bigger until eventually they'd go, so what's tomorrow, Mario? And I went, well, where do you want to start?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I've got an idea about Alexander the Great going over. Bertie is Alexander the Great,
yeah.
And he's on elephants, and Noonan is trying to defeat him with arrows and all this. And I went, okay, anything else?
Yeah.
So, in other words, I opened up my brain and my mind to the idea of just being endlessly, fiercely, unapologetically, ridiculously creative. And thankfully, I was in a room with Dempsey and McLuhan at the time, whereby we could be silly. And that's the most key thing. You need to be in a room where you can be silly and say stupid stuff, and people don't say you're stupid.
Yeah.
But that week, was that everything in it? Was there a moment where you're thinking, oh no, I've been Ken Barlow for 10 years. I'm doing, you know, I know it's different and great, but I've gone down the road. Like, I'm Shakespearean trained. I'm an actor. Mm. I should be doing that.
Yeah.
Varied. And you've taken a Ken Barlow thing or something. Like, did you feel ever tied or restricted in it?
Of being an actor?
No, of being on radio. I was thinking, oh, this isn't what I planned to do. Did you embrace that whole world?
I had to. This week when I went home, I went, I had to have a serious kind of subconscious.
But sorry, was that the week when it all happened?
Yeah,
for you?
That's the week when I went, I'm going to now stop being a fella who does this. I'm going to start being a fella who is this.
Yeah.
Well, right. On that note, and we're going to have to start winding down a little bit now, but what I want to know was, at what point did it go from Gift Grub?
Mm.
Because as far as I remember, my memory could be wrong, but like, I was hugely influenced by this, going to school in the mornings, like stuck in traffic, not wanting to go to school, wanting to be a comedian, wanting to be an actor.
Mm.
Hearing these voices, these sketches on Irish radio, and it was so accessible because it was literally 100.8, there you go, right? It wasn't turn on the telly, it was in my dad's car.
Yeah. And it was 5 days a week.
Yeah, and you'd be Gary Barlow live with Ian.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there'd be a sketch. I was going, and then I heard you're from Waterford, and I was going, this is unbelievable. But at what point
that world comes closer for you then?
Sure, of course.
Is, you know?
But at what point did it, like, because I remember it was just Gift Grub, but then all of a sudden you were Mario Rosenstock.
Yes.
There was a moment when that happened. Do you remember what that was?
Jeepers, that's an interesting point. Yeah, we've talked about that.
Yeah, we both thought of that question.
Interesting one, yeah. I remember seeing Stuart in Navan Man. And he never revealed himself.
That was it.
And I remember thinking, that's a good way to go. And then I remember thinking, after about 8 years, fuck this.
Yeah.
That's not a great way to go, because I can't get enough credit for it, and I want to get more credit for it, and I want to go out in the road, and I want to show my face. I used to do skits in corporates with cardboard faces in front of me. so that I wouldn't see my face.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just daft.
I remember,
because, you see, I was basically not having enough faith in my audience. The audience could do both things at the same time. They could believe in a fella called Mario Rosenstock who has this ability to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's and be Bertie Ahern and be Roy Keane. Of course people can. And that's not a big deal. But I thought it was back then. I thought, because, see, I used to hear these things about, like, you know, De Niro never does interviews.
Yeah.
And I went, because he doesn't want us people to figure him out.
Yeah.
And I'm there, bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Bullshit. You're either a great actor or you're not.
Yeah. And I honestly, I kind of, that's kind of a thing for me, the moment where it was just GIF Grub. And like, I used to be live as Gary Barlow a lot of the time with Ian.
Yeah.
And I actually was like, I was a kid, I was like, is it Gary Barlow?
No, but, well, actually, that was Paul McLoone doing Gary Barlow.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, Paul McLoone, in fairness to him. And he had this particular penchant for doing, you know, it was one of the only characters I didn't do. And the other character I never did either was, I remember hearing a guy, he sent, loads of people would send me in tapes.
Yeah, of course.
And some of them would be obviously awful. Some of them would be surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Like, startling. And one of them, he sent me in and he was just Rob Tom Cruise reading the back of a Glenallan wine bottle. And it was hilarious because he just had no script.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was just a bit like Stephen Roach doing Romeo and
Juliet. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, this is hilarious. Why would Tom Cruise be reading? But the voice was so sickeningly spot on.
Yeah.
Get in here. And so then we had Hector meets Tom Cruise.
That's
Hector. Hector does Collateral, the film with Tom Cruise. How are you, folks?
Genuinely, one of my favourite sketches that GIF Grub did was Hector meets Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Give me the brown bread.
Yeah, yeah. Spondum the Arrogate.
Yeah, Spondum the Arrogate.
This is how, like, the people were going to France for the Irish-France soccer game. Brian Kerr was in charge at the time. Roy Keane had just been brought back.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to France and they said, we had all these pictures sent back to us. Half the Irish fans are wearing T-shirts going to Spondum the Arrogate.
It was one of the best lines I've ever... Show me the money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the sector,
so
yeah.
Good.
And all this sort of stuff. So yeah, so it was bizarre. So it was that idea of transforming into something that you have to believe, you have to embrace. And I knew that in my heart somewhere that I was an actor. So I still am, right? Between yourself and myself, like, right? People go, some of the more serious journalists go, but do you not want to return to the acting?
Mm.
And I'm going, of course I do. But every day I'm acting and I'm writing all the parts myself.
Yeah.
All of them. Whoever I want to be.
Yeah.
It's like Louis C.K. does that bit on Matt Damon. And he says,
yeah.
Have you ever seen Good Will Hunting?
Oh, yeah, so yeah, good.
I don't fucking believe the film at all. But it's written. Then I found out it's fucking written by Matt Damon.
Yeah, he's like,
oh, who gets the girl?
Yeah.
I do. Who the fuck wrote it? Matt fucking Damon wrote it. No wonder he gets the girl. Yeah, he wrote it for himself.
He sits down and he goes, first of all, I'm a genius. And I'm just working at the... And these geniuses can't figure out...
But I'm a down-to-earth genius.
Yeah, it's so good.
Still with my friends.
Yeah. Now, there's a girl. She doesn't like me at the beginning, but then, I know, she falls in love with me.
Yeah, it's so good.
So basically, I write all my own parts. But between yourself and myself, like, I'm still with a casting agent. And yesterday, I went for an audition, right? And I went for an audition for a film.
Yeah,
and you know, usual actor crap. I've come out, and I was really grateful because I came out and I went, you did okay,
brilliant, yeah.
You didn't make a disgrace of yourself, right? But the reason I did the audition was because it was for the man who created one of the greatest films of all time, and he's still alive.
Okay,
and he created Fitzcarraldo. Which is one of my, I'd say, top four films.
Still alive?
Yeah, Werner Herzog. And
I didn't even realise he was still alive.
Making movies.
Wow. Oh, you never heard the news.
Huh? You got it, you bitch.
No, he was going to say about Werner.
It was in the... No,
joking. Oh, no, I thought he was going to say Simon Delaney.
No.
Simon Delaney was there with me as well. And I was like, oh, fuck, Simon's going for it as well.
Are you sure it was Simon, not me? I got mistaken for Simon.
Anyway, so
we've had that.
The magic of that, Tony, that you go, Mario, would you go up for this part? And I went, oh, yeah, it looks like a nice part, but who's doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Tony fucking Kelly?
Yeah.
I've already done it.
Worked with him.
I've worked with him. I've done that. And I went, no, it's Werner Herzog. And they went, you're taking the piss.
Yeah,
Fitzcarraldo.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to turn up. I went, he's going to direct. Yeah, he's writing and directing this.
Mm-hmm.
Of course I'm going to turn up to it. Now, like, the odds are I probably won't get the role.
Well.
But the odds are because...
Yeah, yeah,
that's the thing about... I was looking at a little one with Ben Affleck, and he just went... The whole thing about acting is just crushing, an utter crushing disappointment.
Yeah.
He says, I just never got booked until me and Matt wrote the fucking Good Will Hunting.
With John Krasinski.
And we cast ourselves.
Yeah.
John Krasinski talked about giving up. He was like literally a couple of days away from giving up. But what he'd done was he'd go in and offer to act opposite in the audition.
Yeah, great story about that. Great story about Peter. You remember, was it I Went Down?
Yes. Peter MacDonald.
Peter MacDonald.
Yeah.
So, Pádraig Brnoc was looking for the lead, and Peter was the friend of his, and Peter was reading behind camera for a month.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't find somebody. And
can I read it?
Have a go.
No way.
You're not, you're perfect.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Or here's a beauty. Here's probably the most beautiful. You ever see the Joe Pesci one? Joe Pesci was going nowhere.
He was a musician with Frank Vincent.
Going nowhere. Yeah. And he went, I swear, now when I'm saying going nowhere, I was pretty much going nowhere. I was doing theatre in Los Angeles, small theatres in Los Angeles. And I went, I'm going to give it another 2 weeks. Right. And then I'm going, and at the end of the 2 weeks, nothing happened. And he went, yeah, that's it, I'm going back. So I knew a few lads in the restaurant business in New York, and I went back, and I'm going to start bussing and waiting tables and maybe try and get into the restaurant business. And, hey, Joe, there's a phone call for you. Who? It's a guy called Martin Scorsese. No, it's Martin Scorsese. It's Martin Scorsese. He went, fuck off. It is Martin Scorsese. Scorsese comes on the phone, he goes, Joe? And he says, yeah, is this Martin Scorsese? Said, yeah, it's Martin Scorsese. Friend of mine, Bobby De Niro. He said he saw you in this thing, very low budget.
It's a low budget movie. Seen the movie. Yeah.
And he went, Bobby thinks you're great. Any chance we could come over and have dinner with you? And he went, yeah, sure. They had dinner. Goodfellas.
Yeah, Oscar. Unbelievable.
Goodfellas. Not only Goodfellas, one of the greatest psychos ever created
ever.
For movies.
Ever. But the thing about it, if you do, and please God you do get the Werner Herzog movie, the thing about wanting to work with a director is you know you're going to work with the director. I did a film a few months ago because Steve Coogan is in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God.
Saipan.
He's my idol. I'm going to get to see Steve.
Is he? Do you love Coogan?
Well, he's one of my top five. Yeah. 100, like probably top three or two.
Well, way.
Adore him. Mm. So influenced by him.
Did you meet him on set?
No.
Did you not think he's got lots of writers as well?
He does.
Even though he writes a lot as well.
He does, he's a writer though.
No, he is a writer.
He's
as
a
well.
Genius. But that's the thing. At least if you're want to work with a director,
he's an actor's writer though. He writes like an actor.
He does.
He feels the character and then he starts spilling stuff out and then they write it down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But anyway, that's the lesson there.
Pity you didn't meet him. Who did you play in the film?
I did more of a cameo. I play one of the scouts that sees Roy in the very first scene when he's a kid.
Nice.
And tells him that he's very, look at the size of this little leprechaun, and you're too small.
Yeah, they said.
And we're kind of ha ha ha. So it's going to be the opening scene in the film.
Ah,
it's
brilliant. Really cool,
Speaking of Roy, like when he left, like the Leave Right Now song and all that, and my dear Doris, like when news breaks, are you going, that has to be tomorrow?
Yeah.
And how quickly, just on that one alone, or is that one you go, so will we do a song?
So do you know the way an avalanche happens or a tsunami happens?
Yeah.
And around the world, news stations are all over the world going, we got to break this, you know?
Yeah.
So in a way, there's an element of that to my life as well. Because you just go, you want to be first.
Yeah.
You want to be first. So you want to hear it first. Because Ian's on the radio in the morning. And there's nothing better than being the first person to react to something on the radio. Because he always said that. You're the first in the morning to react. Mm. That means everybody else is just following you for the rest of the day. But if you can be first, you can own it.
But didn't it become almost a thing in Ireland of when something would happen, I wonder what gift
would I would get it on my phone. Yeah. Can't wait for Gift Grub in the morning.
I mean,
Mario, get it every day.
It doesn't get bigger than that.
Ah, thank you. But it's lovely because people, look, I'm in a privileged position that I'm on a radio station. I'm working with somebody like Ian, who we've managed to keep a partnership going together.
Long,
and, and believe me, the partnership is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a great way with comedy as well. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a great way of pretending. Not pretending, because he's there, but
playing
he knows what his role is.
He's playing the foil.
Yeah.
He's the everyman. People believe Ian. I can't.
Before you even say anything else.
Have you been asked that a million times?
Of course, he has a very strange, beautiful, melodic voice that I can't do. Mm. There's some people that their voices, you just can't tap into their pitch at all. Not even near them.
John Colleary.
And there's no parody of him either.
Yeah.
It's hard to do a parody of him.
Mm.
John Colleary can do all the comedians, and he said, I can never do you. And he'll do like Mac Savage, and you close your eyes, it's Mac Savage.
Yeah,
but he's
and
one of them.
And he just goes, I can't do you, and I'm there.
No. You
won't do it in front of me, is it?
We could probably be here all day, right?
I could do loads of comedians as well, so I do Mac Savage and Tommy and all those.
Okay, well, before I give the last question.
We'll do them off there.
Maybe do him off air, yeah, in case we get in trouble. Although McSavage would probably love that.
McSavage would love it.
He'd love that. Do McSavage.
When you say doom, I don't know. Because she's fuck you. Why would I doom?
That's so
good. Doom, I mean, what everybody's doing, everybody. And just, it's kind of a Black Rock thing. It's kind of, he's got a good, you know, accent. But
Dave.
It would, you know.
Right, yeah. I actually watched a bit of Calvary the other night, right?
Yeah.
Brilliant. John Michael.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. And
by the way, this is the, sorry, just to, yeah. on your point.
Yes.
Dave is a terrific
incredible
actor.
Yeah.
Incredible. I was looking
with a
for,
great voice.
I was trying to get, and he won't mind me saying, Patrick Bergen.
Yes.
To play Max Savage's role in The Hurler. It was going to be Patrick Bergen, right? And Lorraine Brennan was my, are you?
No.
No, okay, maybe cut that.
So much can't be said.
Yeah. So anyway, Lorraine Brennan, my agent, I was talking to her, and she was like, I don't know if Patrick's taken work and all that. Now, ironically, I actually met Patrick at a thing a few weeks ago, and I told him, he was like, no one rang me about that.
Anyway,
I was kind of looking for that kind of a person, older, intense, but like calm, intense.
Right.
And I saw McSavage in Calvary. Mm. And I went, oh my God, what a performance. And he was only in this one scene with Brendan Gleeson, or two scenes. I went, Max Savage will be brilliant. And, you know, but then when you get, like, Dave is such a talented actor, but doesn't even know it. He just, he's like, oh, am I doing this the right way now? I'm going to ruin your film. And I'm going,
no, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, like, his performances in Savage Eye were top level dramatic performances.
Yeah, exactly.
Top level.
Yeah.
And that was given to, that was helped by the fact that he was working with a top level film director.
Sure.
Which really helped. That he wasn't working just with a TV sketch director,
yes,
which is a different vibe.
Of course it is.
They made it real filmy.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could, because half the show was interviews with Fintan O'Toole box pops, and then the other half was only 12 minutes.
Yeah, sure.
So you could pour more money and more time into them.
Well, I'm not giving McSavage any more credit because he never gives me credit on his podcast. So anyway, Mario, my last question is going to be, this is a nostalgia podcast, Carl.
Oh, it is.
Is it really?
Yeah. Do you remember?
What would be your favorite?
Is it called Do You Remember?
Yeah. Okay.
If you had to pick one memory professionally.
Yeah.
What's your favorite memory from your career, do you think?
So far, I'd throw three in there.
Okay.
I'd say four. Walking on to stage in the Bord Gáis for the first of five nights that we sold out at the Gift Grub first stage show. We sold 12,000 tickets in 1 week.
Wow.
For that. And that was amazing to hear the crowd for just that performance. Second would be meeting Jose Mourinho in person in a bizarre experience,
crazy,
which was really Jose-ish because he created it. Mm. He created this meeting. It's very Jose funny thing. Third would be meeting Roy Keane.
Okay.
And the Roy Keane when Roy Keane was Roy Keane. Mm. Not when Roy Keane was funny bearded pundit.
Yeah.
When Roy Keane was the savage Roy Keane.
Yeah.
And nobody had met him. And nobody in our world had met
mm-hmm.
him. And the last one, I suppose, would be, again, it was a bit of magic, was that it was the whole Aikino experience. So working with Arthur Matthews and the creator of Father Ted.
Yeah.
And the creator of Father Ted putting his creative mind into the madness of the Mick McCarthy, Roy Keane world.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked me to play Keane and then working with the Après Match guys at the same time. So we had never worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there was a little bit of a professional
rivalry.
Yeah. And we even had a bit of a rivalry of who'd go on top of the poster and all that.
Oh, well, listen, that's real showbiz, baby.
And so walking out with Richard and Gary and then having it written by Arthur and directed by Peter Sheridan on that story and not knowing what was going to happen. And we didn't have the greatest of faith in it.
Okay, wow.
Not at all. It didn't look great on paper.
Mm.
It looked bizarre, farcical,
mm-hmm.
as it should be, but too farcical.
Okay.
Civil wars will do that.
We were kind of going like, you know, lads are in dresses and in togas and there's boats going across the stage and then we sing Bohemian Rhapsody at each other.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a stretch. And then it just had that mad manic energy of its own with the audience. Mm-hmm. So the first night there was four rows, all in green jerseys. They'd never been to the theatre before.
Oh sure. My God.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I came out, so my opening line is McCarthy's on stage going with his sword and his dress, and he's going something like, you know, he's going something like, oh, we're in trouble here. We're in trouble. We're in big trouble. I wonder what he's thinking or what he's doing. And I'm sneaking up behind him. My opening line on the page just says, hello.
Oh, God.
Right? So I come up behind him and they see me coming out and I just go, hello. Right? Now, 3 minutes later, the standing ovation stop and the crying laughing stops. And I'm going, but what did I do? All I said was said hello.
But it got a laugh out of us.
No,
as
but
well.
It was, the point was that Steve they had invested, but they had invested all this energy in their idea of the show, that they were putting all that energy onto me.
You.
So on page, it just went hello. In the reality, it was bringing the house down. And the last anecdote there was the same thing. One of my entrances in Ikeno was ridiculous. I had to exit entrance through the balcony, one of those balcony things in the Olympia.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to come through the door and then light would shine on me and I would sing a big I'm going to fuck you up song in one of those things. And so I used to go up to the door and then they would be on the thing and they'd go, Mario, 10 seconds to enter. 9, 2, enter Mario. I hit the door. The door was locked. Somebody forgot to open the door.
No.
And I'm there. Boom, boom. Mario, enter now. Light is on. And the adrenaline came through my body.
Oh,
like
my God.
I put my foot. I hit the door like one of those.
You kicked through the door.
Like
Joaquin.
Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah.
Oh, right? My God.
I went like this. I just stood back and I went.
And then
kicked the door in, right? Splints came off the door. There's two people in the balcony like this with their pint of Carlsberg. With a Roy Keane with a dress on going, this is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Literally splints of the door.
Oh,
they thought
God.
It was part of the show. And I was basically so much adrenaline that I just kicked the door through to get onto stage. And that was, I could have killed myself with a splint through the leg or something.
Oh,
and they
God.
Thought, these two people who were in the thing having their pints, they must have thought, this is
the great. They actually,
yeah. How did they do that one?
Yeah, I was there the night Roy Keane played the character.
Yeah. They gimmicked the door.
So those would be
brilliant.
Because they're real.
Yes.
Those ideas
what,
are
what
real.
Was he like when you met him? I remember hearing it and you were doing the laugh to him and he could, I don't laugh like that.
Yeah.
And it was
so
like.
So what happened was, what I found most peculiar is, and this was the thing that sealed it for me. He was willing, they asked for me. He was willing to interact as Roy Keane with Roy Keane being Roy Keane to Roy Keane.
Yeah.
And I thought, this guy is different level.
Yeah.
This guy gets showbiz. And that's the guy that proved right. Proved right. He's been doing it now for 20 years.
He's very funny. He's incredible.
He has paracomic timing. You see the way he's willing to do anything. You see when he's in one of his promos and he looks great. He's got a great dramatic face.
Yeah.
And we went home that day and we went, he's fucking different gravy.
He's performing every week on TV
and
now.
And he wanted to meet me. So, and then I did this thing down in Cork recently, last 2 years ago for the curling team. And they went, lads, he's here, apparently. He's coming in tonight. I went, who's coming in tonight? Roy. I went, is he? What the fuck was he coming in? He loves the impressions. And this is the thing, Keane loves Coogan.
He's
and
a big comedy fan.
Big comedy fan. But he actually loves the sketch comedy.
Mm-hmm.
He loves Coogan and he likes the stuff that I would do. I think he likes Connor Moore as well, and Connor's brilliant impressionist.
Yes.
And so he likes that aspect of comedy.
Right.
It's easy to digest. I don't know if he would like Larry Sanders now. I would like.
I toured with Kevin Bridges, and there was all these footballers and football people coming in. So like Brendan Rodgers, Jack Grealish, meeting them all after the gigs. And I said to Kevin, I wonder what Roy Keane, because we were in Manchester for like 4 or 5 nights. And going, well, the last time he came, but he just bought his ticket. So Kevin was getting tweeted afterwards going, oh, Roy Keane was there tonight and he was laughing. He just, none of this, oh, I'll meet you afterwards. Just wanted to go see the show. And
dude, he came
do his
to
own
Ikea.
Thing.
Yeah.
You can't imagine watching yourself
being lampooned as a great
and you're in the audience.
Crazy. I mean,
we remember the nights. There's like we see, who's in tonight? So Brian O'Driscoll sitting beside Paul McGrath and John Aldridge.
Wow.
It was just hilarious watching these super, because that was all accessible to
of
them.
Of course, yeah.
So you'd see people at the theatre who'd never go, you know.
Yeah. And do any scope to just throw in a different line or
never.
Anything like that?
Not at all. No, we really stuck. Like if you
You're
listen,
such an actor.
No, not me. Not me, but not me.
You.
No, Arthur Matthews.
It's a theatre, man.
If you the theatre. If you read anything about Father Ted, you'll find that not one exclamation mark or comma was changed.
Oh, right. Wow.
And Dermot used to go, what about if I just go like that? And they went, no.
Believe it or not.
Graham didn't like
who,
any transitions.
I know.
Who are they? Those are the two lads that wrote it.
Believe it or not, the late, great John Kenny told me that exact thing. I said to him, did you have any scope when you were doing the careful now, you know, that when he's the cinema owner? And he went, every word that was said in that episode was written on the page.
Oh, they had everything worked out. I mean, remember the racist scene where he's the that's basically worked out as well to a T.
Yeah.
They would have stayed there for an hour going, no, the piece
it's
of thing
too
isn't
over that.
That's the way the script was as well. Every joke small, far away.
Yeah.
Small. They were mathematical.
They were.
Yeah, yeah.
They were mathematical.
Lads, listen, we'll continue this off mic. It's been a beautiful conversation.
Yeah,
this is going to be the longest podcast in history, but it's okay.
I'm
Mario,
on stage at 8 tonight.
Always love. And can I tell you, we've both been on your podcast.
Yeah.
It's brilliant turning the mic around and having a
podcast. It's lovely, isn't it? And this is the wonderful world about the podcast.
That's it.
Wonderful thing about the podcast. We get to know each other, mm-hmm. get to share things, anecdotes, and stories. I just think podcasting is amazing.
Thank you. Well, we'll see you again soon.
With Car Guru's Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and Car Guru's Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder Car Guru's is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with Car Guru's at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com.